Space Oddity.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Space Oddity, the podcast of the CSC 1265. It has been some time since the last episode of Space Oddity. Summer has passed, followed up by a sparkling autumn in Berlin. The CSC is currently working together on the renewal proposal for the next funding phase. The new winter term has started, and with it, the return of life to the university campus. We also had our annual conference this autumn, as you may have noticed. Our sixth international conference took place in mid-October from the 10th to 11th at the main building of the TU Berlin. The aim of this year's conference was to show the diversity and heterogeneity of conflicts in space, spatial conflicts, and the confrontation with the multiple specialties around us. That's why we've invited the famous anthropologist Arjun Appadurai as an opening keynote speaker. Appadurai was a professor at New York University until 2021 and is now emeritus. In today's recording, we will listen to Arjun Appadurai's ideas on the territory of affect, polymorphous populism and national boundaries, which is based on an essay from this year. The link is in the show note. So, see you next time and enjoy Arjun's talk.
So the first section is on this term polymorphous populism, which is in the second part of my title, but I think a slightly exotic term, so I thought I would engage with it right away. So I use the term polymorphous populism to invoke Freud's idea of polymorphous perversity, creatively transformed by the great Herbert Marcuse, notably in his book Eros and Civilization. Freud saw children as living in a world where all sites of sensory contact could produce erotic pleasure, and their socialization into adulthood and civilization, he saw, as whittling down this diffuse eroticism and leaving only the genitals as the focus of permissible erotic sensation. Freud saw this narrowing as both necessary and desirable. Marcuse, as well as some other of Freud's more unruly followers, such as Sándor Ferenczi, refused this reduction. Marcuse, for example, made the restoration of polymorphous perversity the main strategy in the battle against what he called surplus repression. Marcuse believed that polymorphous perversity would open up the terrain of affect to a wider sensory palette and thus offer a profound erotic complement to the battle against capitalist discipline, alienated labor, and administered sexuality. The subsequent debates about Marcuse's revision of Freud have been intense, but they are less relevant to me anyway than the idea itself. So what does the idea of polymorphous perversity offer us? And I give a preliminary shot at it right away in our effort to understand the global success of the right. And I'm going to come to this, the global right, what we sometimes refer to as authoritarian movements, populist authoritarianism. We have different terms, but we know what we're talking about. What can this idea offer to our understanding of that? And that will bring me around to territory and nation, you'll see in a moment. I suggest that the object of polymorphous perversity, a diffuse, multi-sensorial, erotic economy which resists restriction or localization, has been shifted by the right, capital R, from the body to the people, who are now presented as an amorphous, tactile, erotic organism which refuses reduction to the electorate, the citizenry, the population, or any other demographic criteria. I urge you to think of Donald Trump this way. He cannot be reduced to any of those things. It's somehow a more woozy, blobby, leaky phenomenon when he invokes the people. It's not a going to Rousseau or going here or going there. So in and the people in this polymorphous construction do not need the courts, the constitution, the official media, or even the usual forms of public opinion. Polymorphous populism is the deep connection between leaders as different as Trump and the man I will talk about soon at some length, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India today. And it installs the people as a pre-political erotic category with no prior limits, boundaries, or regulations. The right captured the terrain of affect. This is the territory I'm talking about. By replacing the very idea of democracy, capital D, with the idea of the people, capital P, as a pre-political, quasi-biological entity. And this idea is not just an appeal to masses, mobs, and crowds, the usual sociological exemplars of rule by emotion. That is what we think usually. Emotion means those people. It is an appeal to, I think, a different collective horizon, one constituted by networks of emotions rather than of actors, agents, thank you, Hubert, and persons linked into groups. So networks of emotions. These networked emotions are anchored in a mass sensorium, which then recodes actually existing citizens into followers of leaders who tap this polymorphous populism. So I'm hinting here and there about some slightly different approach to all our existing terms from political theory, democratic theory, etc. So I seek to channel Marcuse then to account in the first place for the right-wing capture of the terrain of affect. I believe that the real battleground, or the primary battleground, is not the economy by any definition, but affect, also broadly defined. The forces of left liberalism, represented by everyone in this room, I imagine, certainly me, lost the battle over the economy because of the worldwide increase in wealth, wages, and social extras, because capitalism delivered on some of its promises for affluence, even if highly unequally, as many people have pointed out in Germany and elsewhere. The poor got either poorer or less equal worldwide, but the geometric increase, which is very hard to deny, in wealth and GDP in most countries opened the door to aspirations for upward social mobility, a new aspirational horizon which appeared to require just a bit of patience and some luck, even as inequality sharpens. It looks as if the left is losing the battle in the terrain of affect as well. That is not just in regard to the economy. But here I focus on the obverse question: how did the right capture this terrain? The usual answer is rarely stated explicitly, but it relies on the liberal view of demagoguery and propaganda, in which demagogues appeal to the baser instincts of mankind and are an easy path to the hearts and minds of poorer, less educated, subaltern populations. These populations are viewed, or these leaders are viewed as catering to demotic prejudices, vulgar pleasures, and vernacular ressentiment. They are an ideological version of those circuses which seek to distract from the scarcity of bread. In short, in this view, insofar as the life of emotions is reductive, or seen as reductive, inflammatory, and pre-rational, the right, it is felt that the right has a natural appeal to the untutored mob. It is evident that this view of demagoguery and propaganda is itself elitist and prejudiced, since it sees the terrain of affect itself through a Cartesian lens, in which the left is reason and the right is emotion. There is a more thoughtful way, I think, to account for the emotional currency which the right has made its own. And that path will bring us to territory and also to the example of India today. And now I switch gears to come back to the main track of my argument, to the question which has obsessed me for basically about 40 years. It won't go away, I won't leave it alone, and it won't leave me alone. And that is the question of the nation form. And I have said in many writings again and again, in spite of thousands of changes in the global economy, in transnational sovereignties, in this and that, it won't go away. We all know this. We can wish and hope and think what we like. It's there. It's always there. And the central question that has obsessed me, because I don't have an answer to it, and I'm still looking, so today's talk is a way, another look for an answer, looking this way rather than that way, to why does a nation produce so much attachment? In other words, why is it the only large-scale social form for which people will kill or die? Now, people will do it for other things, but they are insofar as they are somewhat national in the way they work. So here, notice I'm against the family-based theory of these things. If anything is like a family, it will become a little bit like that. I think it's the reverse. I think it's the nation. I'll try and sketch why. But I have been asking this question because if you go back to the classics on nationalism, such as Benedict Anderson, who rightly said, why would people kill and die for this? He has no answer. Honestly, he has no answer. He talks about cartography, he talks about this, and he's a great thinker. Foucault also took his shot at this big, and these are big minds. These are heavyweights, so to speak, 800-pound gorillas. But on this question, they have no clear answer. And there are others, also giant Stuart Hall, this one, that one, even Said. They tell us a lot. We learn a lot. But if I ask a simple question, why are people, this is, as I have said again, ad infinitum, but I have to repeat it. The nation is young, it's artificial, and it's plainly fragile. Yet people will go to any lengths, including life and death, their lives, other people's lives, for this abstraction, which is at a certain level. So if you take the scale and say, please go and die for the world, people will laugh in your face. But if people, I said this in 1996, if you're a member of the American Medical Association as a doctor and somebody tells you, go for a war, let's kill all the psychologists because we are doctors, you'll laugh in their faces. Who's going to kill or die for being in this or that profession or Beowulf or something like that? People laugh in your face. Not only they won't do it, they'll laugh. But the nation, very abstract, very arbitrary, and very young. People will do this for, and people all over the world. It's the governing form. Again, I've been one of the people who was hoping at one time that other things were beginning, transnational loyalties, diasporas, this, that. Now I look and look and look, and the answer is, yeah, they're all there, and so is the nation, running across all of them and surviving all of them. So I just want to let you know that this is my problem, that love of the nation then is no mere figure of speech. Parades bring people to their feet. National anthems produce lumps in the throat, and flags induce tears in the eye. Insults to national honor can greatly assist internal mobilization, and violations of national sovereignty can create irate mobs. Sacrifice, passion, anger, hate are all part of the symphony of affects in which love, here love of the nation, is the orchestrating force. So regularly has love of the nation been invoked by nationalists through every medium of communication that we have ceased to pay attention, because we are inured to it, we hear it all the time, to what is this thing about? So we have ceased to examine it, I think, in the way we should. So, can this peculiar affective mode be illuminated, this is my question, by examining the principle of territorial sovereignty, which comes straight, I think, to the heart of today and this conference and your project, and that's why I'm very admiring of what you're doing. Yes, If we recognize that love of the nation is both a peculiar form of love and also the love of a peculiar kind of object. Consider first what sort of love it is. It is neither erotic nor agapic, to invoke the classic distinction between Greeks and Christians. It is both. It is erotic in the sense that it involves the sensation of connection, possession, and pleasure. It is agapic in the sense that it is communal, selfless, and even abstract. It is this peculiar sort of love to which we gave the name patriotism, which, as you know, some people have said is not exactly nationalism. That's a tricky business because it's a slippery slope. The history of patriotism and, you might say, matriotism as a sentiment, because India, for example, is Mother India. That's a whole another question. Why are some places father and some places mother? The history of patriotism and matriotism as a sentiment, as sentiments, is yet to be written. But when it is written, it will solve some part of the puzzle of what may be described, and I have described some years ago in a kind of critical engagement with the great Jürgen Habermas as full attachment. Full attachment. By full attachment, I meant then and I mean now that surplus of affect which exceeds civic commitment, attributor of legitimacy to a state, or even what Habermas himself has called constitutional patriotism. It's a surplus. It cannot be reduced to things. And to his credit, I think Habermas knew that, that constitutional patriotism is just a good thing to want or to have. But he doesn't address this surplus. And what I want to say here is that there's a long, I have many examples here of the way that modern nations have emerged, how peasants, in Eugen Weber's term, became Frenchmen, Scots turned into Britons, Hindus into Indians, and so on and so forth. And for some nations to be imagined in Anderson's phrase and others to be unimaginable. What do you mean you can have a nation? That kind of thing. So today, Palestinians are people who nation is unimaginable for most people. And of course, national memory requires large amounts of forgetting, notably the forgetting of prior nodes of identification, previous enmities, more intimate attachments, but they have to be put in delete. How does this happen? Another tough question. And there's a big literature on it. And the person that I take my inspiration from here is, I think, one of the best respondents to the fact that blood, race, language, history, even culture, all have pre-national expressions and non-national applications. So what's the national special thing about them? You can't just say, well, it's language, it's blood. Well, language is everywhere, blood is everywhere. Everywhere, I mean, in every place and in every century. So you can't identify the nation state with one of those things. So the inspiration I get, and some of you may know that I've also in this lifelong obsession been trying to distinguish words like land, territory, soil, which is where a lot of the folkish thinking comes from. These are not the same. So land goes straight to property. Soil, not so. And territory, yet more complex. So these words have to be unpacked. I've written on that explicitly in the past, so I won't repeat. I will say the person who has inspired me about this question, which goes to then why the left has lost its claim of the terrain of affect, how the right has captured it, which we should understand, in a non-elitist, non-patronizing way, where we are reason and they are emotion. That gets us exactly nowhere. It's highly stereotyping, prejudiced, and unproductive view. I mean, it doesn't take you anywhere. It's name-calling. So I can do that, you know, and Kamala Harris can do that to Trump, as Trump does to her. But it makes no progress for us. But the thinker in question who long ago inspired me, again, this is not a recent discovery, is Etienne Balibar, who along with two or three other people, but not many, wrote about nation in his book on class, race, etc. an insight that was head-changing for me. Namely, it's not nations that produce violence. We know that. Armies, they fight, they shed blood. But violence that produces nations. In other words, you need blood to be shed by armies. And then the question becomes, how do the armies get recruited? There are other more fine-grained questions. But those experiences with the enactment of violence is when the affect of nationalism gets generated, implanted, and installed. It may not be 100% successful. But the key is, don't get it wrong and say, well, nations are there, so we have a bloody and violent world. No, we have a bloody and violent world which nations employ to their advantage through all kinds of practices, of which the obvious ones are the war, military blood spilled, sacrifice, etc., but also schooling. The great work that we have from Bourdieu and many others, that schooling is a violent process. And it's a violent in all kinds of ways, including corporal punishment and so on and so forth. Penal institutions. Therefore, Foucault is useful, but you have to have a basic insight first, that the nation does not proceed, that the nation comes out of it. So I take something serious from that, and therefore I use it to explain how we can get to full attachment. And by full attachment, I mean that surplus which sets the nation apart happens because in the history of modern nationalisms, wherever they are, you will find a creative use of violence to produce, reproduce, and maintain the affect surrounding the nation. And here I should mention in parentheses that that is never self-sustaining. It's an endless labor. So it's not like you kick nationalism off and then you watch it run on its own. And you might say, looking back to the darkest periods in German history, the 20th century, that, for example, the Nazis may well have thought that they created a machine and then you just let the machine run, fuel it here and there, tinker with the parts. No, you have to keep it working. A lot of what Hitler did and his regime did was an unconscious recognition that you have to keep the fire stoked. You cannot just set the machine in place and let it run. But it's not only Germany in the first half of the 20th century, but many, many, many places where we can see that the challenge of full attachment, that is to say attachment which goes above and beyond anything functional or utilitarian, it also goes beyond, far beyond, something that I think someone like Habermas is in this way very much caught in Weberian thinking. And Max Weber is one of my heroes. I think of myself as a dwarf sitting on his shoulders. So this is not at all a general critique of the great Weber. But he did spend a tremendous amount of his work on a key word, legitimation. Now that word, at which Habermas picks up, legitimation crisis. Where did the word come from? Nobody else in the first half of the 20th century in Germany or late 19th century was worrying about legitimacy. Weber was. Others may have been aware of it, but he spent a lot of energy on it. And now I realize it somehow does not get you to the productive power of violence in creating this sentiment. Because legitimation is a kind of slightly civic sentiment. It's soft, it's cuddly, it's nice. I'm legitimate. Anybody can claim that, and people over time, kings, empires, monarchs, heads of charismatic movements, everybody says, you know, I can do this because my father did this. I mean, some kind of Weberian legitimacy, but that is, at the end, a bit anemic. It does not explain the fierce surplus of affect and attachment. So I you can point to other words, but legitimacy or legitimation is the big one which can put you on the wrong track. It can put you on the track of, yeah, well, there's a kind of legitimacy crisis, or there's deficiency in legitimacy, or this or that. Well, maybe so, but it doesn't give the whole answer. The whole answer has to be a bypass of that into a direct set of questions about full attachment. And I want to say there are various moves. One of them is Ben Anderson, but there are others which I think don't quite account for this surplus of affect, which I'm calling full attachment, which is produced by various forms of violence, instigated and perhaps even required by the modern nation state. So many theorists of nationalism would agree that the modern nation state is able to mobilize, conscript, and deploy its citizens in warfare or preparation for it, because it already has some prior and plausible claims to full attachment. But the truth is that the key is what is different about the nation. So to say it's a little bit like the church, the point is it's crucially not the church. So the fact that it manages to make me feel there is something sacred about it, and for that I will die and kill, but I'm still not, it's still not the Christian order or the Protestant order or Luther or this or that, there's a difference. And if you can't account for the difference, which always happens in these moves, these explanatory moves, well, it's again like a little bit like religion. Well, it's a little bit like religion, but many things are a little bit like religion, and other things are a little bit like the nation state, a little bit like, you know, won't work. We have to go for the what the linguists and others would call the distinctive feature. What's the thing that makes nationalism nationalism? Not a little bit like this and a little bit like that. That's hard, but that's why we have great projects like yours to at the end say, here's the answer. So I wait, I look for it, because it won't come today, I assure you. But I want to give you an example by way of conclusion, and let me just ask Hubert, how many minutes would you say I have? 10? 15. Excellent, perfect. Thank you. So now I turn, having laid the grounds a bit for what I'm saying, namely that Marcuse gives me an idea of the liquidity of and the fluidity of attachment to people, which is not just about erotics, but it's about populism. So you make people a very loose thing. And if it's so loose, free-flowing, liquid, and endemic, who cares about courts? Who cares about, you know, other forms of public opinion? They are minor compared to all the rest. But if you take that Marcuse route and then come to the nation, which I do think is a special site, as I said, of this kind of excess of attachment, which you don't find for many other things in the same way at the aggregate or macro level. Yes, of course, if somebody attacks my wife and children or my husband and children, yeah, I will feel all kinds of things. But that's not a scalable analysis. So the idea of, you know, the nation is one big family. Well, yes, then the family is one small nation. So that's the end of sociology. You have a textbook of sociology will be 5 pages, you know. We have 5 forms, one is small, one is big, and we don't understand all of them. You know, so clearly we can't go that way. So I'm interested in that level. And we know that's not a minor level, even in our world today. So I want to turn to Modi's India. So by way of quick background, for those of you who may not spend day and night thinking about Narendra Modi and his party, to remind you, first of all, population of India is 1.4 billion. So even if you have only very minor interest in Modi, let me say that minor interest is applying to 1.4 billion people out of the population of 7. You add China, you go beyond half. So if you explain India and China, you've explained numerically a very large proportion of it. But those of us who labor in India studies and teach about India or South Asia, no, you can't just rely on that, because there's a long history of minorization, marginalization. That's an area of studies. That's the global south. That's that. Okay. But the truth is, it's a 1.4, now let me add, billion electoral democracy. How many examples do you have of that? It's Europe multiplied by, I don't know how many, factor of how much. Or the US, a handsome 300 million. 300 million. That's you know, 10 times the size of Bombay where I grew up, the city. So size counts, aggregation counts. It's a very big country, and it has been for 75 years a true electoral democracy, not some fake affair. 30, 40 years ago, when the wall was crumbling here in Germany and everything was going to hell for the Soviet Union and the US was singing the songs of triumph of market, freedom, democracy, but already the bad stuff had begun in Eastern Europe, in Rwanda, etc. I made the outrageous suggestion in some informal context that maybe people should look at a place like India. That you've been struggling with diversity, language, this, that. Oh, India, what are you talking about? Next thing you'll say is, people in Poland should go to Africa. I say, yeah, well, you might want to consider it. Now, that is being taken seriously because these experiences are all on one historical plane. There's no waiting room of history where two-thirds of mankind is waiting for the message. What is happening in Boston? What is happening in the bowling alleys? Are we bowling alone or together? You know, people don't care because history has moved along, time has moved along. From that point of view, it's very important to pay attention. So what I will say is that in India for the last approximately 25 years, perhaps more, the major party of Hindu fundamentalism has been making huge inroads and has moved from a marginal movement to a central force. Indeed, it's the ruling party today. The only analogy I can show for you is that IFD was today already fully in power in Germany, and everybody else was looking for a little bit of the vote. That's the Indian story. And it's a story of an electoral democracy, a big one, hugely organized. Indian election is one of the largest public policy organizations in the world. They bring millions, I won't say billions because there are still people who don't have the vote, to the polls every few years. It's a miracle of organization, coordination, mobilization. It's also packed with corruption. It's been hijacked by various parties, but it is there. You can't say, oh, therefore there's not a democracy. Yeah, compared to whom? You know, it's a very serious endeavor, and it has been more or less successfully, slowly been taken over by the BJP, the party of the Hindu right, which is clearly, if nothing else, not only against Pakistan, but against India's Muslims wholesale. How many is that? 200 million. So, if you want 200 million people to somehow become minor, or perhaps ideally disappear somehow, that's no small thing. It's a huge project, and it gives me hope because you will never do that, ever. So you have to simply make them less powerful, less dignified, less recognized. There are no camps big enough in India to put 200 million Muslims, not to speak of another 150 million Dalits. It can't be done. So, in the last election in 2020, early this year, there was pushback because Modi basically tried to undo democracy everywhere, in the parliament, in the courts, in the media, which is now basically in his pocket and so on, but all without any coup. So it's a kind of bizarre democratic process in which, and I've written on this before in different parts of the world, that the main point of elections now is to elect people who hate elections in different parts of the world, including Austria, for example. So we have elections for people who are thoroughly anti-democratic. But you want to vote them into power. You don't want to just have a putsch. India is the same. It's happened that way. But I want to mention three practices which fit the Balibar model. How does Modi produce this excess attachment, even though he's being contested? Thank God for that. There is some question about the absoluteness of his hold on India. So, the first policy, a total disaster, is a policy that's known now. It was in 2016, 2 years after he came to power. He came to power basically 10 years ago. He launched a policy which is transparently insane called demonetization. And what he said was two currency notes, 500 rupees and 1,000 rupees, which are very important in India for all kinds of people purposes, are simply by fiat no longer viable. Boom! Here is a country, most of the people don't have bank accounts, they don't have ATMs, they're in a cash economy, petty traders, farmers. The rich, of course, didn't care. They just moved to the higher notes and they moved to their overseas bank accounts. They did this. They basically didn't have much of a complaint. But it created a horrendous amount of suffering. And the suffering was, I give the short version now, justified in the language of sacrifice. This is for the nation and so on. The policy was plainly insane. It didn't even, one of the excuses for it was it will eliminate corruption because people are using what they call black money. Well, all true, but the black money people have billions in bank accounts everywhere, in various assets, real estate. You're not going to touch them with 500 rupees. Or the only people you hurt are very poor or ordinary working class people. So it was a monumental failure. Even Modi doesn't talk about it, but it had an insane touch in it. But the logic was sacrifice for the nation. Oh, is it painful? Oh, that's the nation, you know, you have to hurt. So it fits in a whole way that he has presented himself also as an ascetic, as a holy man, you know, he's notoriously unmarried. So it's that side of the kind of Gandhian, you know, I'm not engaged in the real world, etc. All completely manufactured, because he does it wearing, you know, 4 watches, 10 designer glasses. Hold on, that's the Modi story. I don't want to get started on it. But so this is one. You suffer horribly, and the answer is you must give not blood, but some other form of suffering. Second place is a huge inflation in something all of you will recognize, but in India is at a high pitch, which is the cultification of military deaths on the India-Pakistan border. Kargil, there's a place called Kargil, which is now like become, I don't know what the analogy is, an event in 1999 where the Indians defeated their most intimate enemy, namely Pakistan. But that place of those deaths is worship now in 1,000 ways. And so this is an active maintenance and inflation of the loss of life in military action for the nation. Again, a known thing, but somewhat quieter in other places. Occasionally there's Dunkirk, there's that. But this kind of national hysteria around Kargil and the Indian Army and its sacrifices is very cynical and very effective. That's a second. The third and last is the following. In a month before the elections of 2024, when eventually Modi did get a lot of pushback, lost a lot, now has a coalition government, he created an unbelievably huge temple called the Ram Mandir, Ram temple, the god, hero, warrior god, Rama, very basic, very important, huge, in the city of Ayodhya, where in 1993, the Hindu right had destroyed a Muslim mosque. So it's on the site of that wound that this mega temple, unnecessary because there are many Ram temples. It's not like there's a gap that you're filling. But it's an enormous structure, and he was the center of the drama. The priests, the others were all minor. It was him as a combination of ascetic, king, Hindu king, etc., etc. Huge, huge image. Here's the denouement of that story. He did it very well. It was a huge spectacle. It mobilized that entire regional state, Uttar Pradesh. It created new train tracks, new airports, new hotels. It was just a massive effort. At the end, in that very town, his party got defeated. Because, of course, the town realized that they were mere props in some huge racket, some huge national racket, and they voted him down, and that was a huge embarrassment. because the chief minister of the regional state actually had been a bit pissed off that Modi was dismissing him. So he pulled the plug on the rope. So there's a story there, but the main one is on the very site, he lost. But the point is the effort had echoes all over India and mobilized us for everywhere. So I'll conclude just by saying that these three are examples today, within the last 4 or 5 years, up to this year, of using different forms of violent mobilization. By the way, what I haven't mentioned is that the killing, public killing, rape, and legal abuse of Muslims, of women, and of Dalits is the steady noise behind all these big events. It is constantly going on. It's very risky to speak up as a Muslim, a Dalit, and in many cases as a woman. And you all doubtless following the horrendous cases of physical violence against members of all these three categories. So that's the constant background noise against which these mobilizations are going on. So when I use violence, it's not simply because you build a temple that's violent. No, the temple is in the face of the Muslims there. So all this I can now conclude by saying the challenge for those of us who share some liberal progressive sentiments is practically how to recapture some of the terrain of affect and analytically how to really make progress on the peculiar nature of excess attachment to the nation form. So I stop. Thank you very much.